Yes, hello. I'm Jason Louv, and this is the Ultra Culture Podcast. So this week's episode is something a little different. It's a recording of a talk I gave in 2005, along with several other people, for the opening, for the launch party for Generation Hex, which was my first book, which was an anthology about magic and its popularity in youth culture at the time in 2005. Obviously, it's gotten a lot more popular since 2005, but what I did at that time was write an anthology where I collected all of the experiences of people my age, I was 23, 24 at the time, who were into magic and shamanism and being psychonauts and world religion and that type of thing, because I knew at the time that magic was going to be huge. Now, obviously, I was following on a lot of previous work that had been done, like, for instance, Genesis Peorage's Temple of Psychic Youth. Grant Morrison had really, really stumped for magic becoming popular in culture at the time that he was writing the Invisibles comic book. And actually, it was Grant Morrison that encouraged me to put Generation Hex together. I had the chance to do a book because I was working at the Disinformation Company in New York at the time, just out of college. And I had the opportunity to pitch them a book. And I'd asked Grant about it, and he said, what you should really do if you're going to do a book about magic is just, you know, talk about your experiences. Just be totally honest about it and tell people what you experienced. Don't be spooky about it. Don't put on airs. Don't be kind of Kenneth Granty about it or try to be a guru. Just, you know, be honest and tell people what you experienced. So I kind of went with that. And so the idea of Generation Hex was not to create a new occult manual. There's tons of those out there, you know, and particularly the chaos magicians, you know, like Peter Carroll and Phil Hine and guys like that, or Christopher Hyatt, wrote a lot of very great practical manuals distilling how to do magic very clearly. And obviously, you know, there's always Crowley and people like that. But the idea with Generation Hex was not to do another grimoire and not to be kind of spooky about it, but to do an anthology of what doing magic was actually like, right? So what I did was I collected contributors. In order to get into the book, you had to be under 30, you know, following on from the classic 1960s dictum, never trust anyone over 30. You know, I'm 34 now, so I definitely would not get into the book. And certainly I would not, younger me would not trust older me, and neither should anybody listening to this. That was the idea, was to focus on young people just getting into magic instead of, for instance, people who had been practicing it their whole life and become masters of it. This was to get the experience of people who were just getting that initial rush of initiation or just discovering these ideas for the first time and capturing what that's like. So I ended up with about, I think, 13 contributors in all, including myself. And some of them are much more well-known now. Mickey Pellerano, artist in New York, is one of them. Scott Trelevin, a very famous collage artist, is another one. Everyone contributed beautiful essays, you know, from their own angles, which were very, very different. So we got chaos magicians, stuff from Thelema, people who looked at magic as an artistic expression, kind of all over the map. And it somehow, you know, even though I was very young, somehow it all clicked together and really captured the zeitgeist at that time. And if I can give myself a little bit of credit, I think that it really inspired the huge popularity of magic in youth culture now. You know, obviously, if you're listening to this, you're probably aware that magic is incredibly popular now, in particularly in Brooklyn and New York, Los Angeles, London. And there was even a report that came out a few months ago from K-Hole, which is kind of a media prankster outfit posing as a trend spotting group, corporate trend spotters. They released a report that said chaos magic would be the next big youth culture. And I think there's definitely some truth to that. That's definitely what I was saying in Generation Hex. In order to do this book, it took me about two years. I got the book contract when I was 21, and I immediately flew to London, where I spent a year completely immersed, not only in meeting all the big heads of, you know, the magical orders in the UK, and the big chaos magicians and people like that, but completely immersed in the practice of the study and practice of magic, both from the intellectual angle and just practicing day in, day out, both individually and in groups. And at the end of that, I ended up, through a series of coincidences, in Kathmandu in Nepal, undergoing shamanic initiation, as you do, which was a story that made its way into the book. I'd planned to go to India originally, because I'd been traveling around Europe, looking at alchemical sites and, for instance, the Alchemist Quarter in Prague and exploring occult sites in Europe. But Europe is obviously very, very expensive. And after just a few weeks, I was like, okay, my money's running out. where can I go? So I decided to go to India because, you know, if you're going to study magic, you should really go to India. And obviously, it's much cheaper than Europe. So I booked a flight to India. And unfortunately, I missed my flight because I was in my last year of school in London. And the date for the exams went past the flight to India. So I missed the flight. I went back to the travel company and said, you know, can I be rebooked? They said, we don't have any more tickets for India. We're very sorry. But, after I complained a bit, but we do have a ticket to Kathmandu if you want to go to Kathmandu. So I said, sure, why not? That sounds awesome. Figuring that even if I didn't like Nepal, I could just get on a bus and go to India because it's right on the border to northeastern India. So I believe the day of my flight to Kathmandu, it was announced in the news that Nepal had erupted into civil war, and that Maoist insurrectionaries were, causing huge amounts of trouble. But I decided to go anyways because otherwise I would lose all the money for my ticket, and how bad could it really be? So I landed in Kathmandu only to be figuring. Again, that even if there was strife, I could just immediately get on a bus from the airport and go to India. Unfortunately, I was informed that Maoist insurrectionaries were firebombing buses that were leaving Nepal. So there was no way to get into India. I was stuck in Kathmandu. Well, right then I figured, so I might as well enjoy myself. So I spent quite a while wandering around Kathmandu, checking into a hostel and wandering around and being confronted with this incredible psychedelic, magical, tantric city. Kathmandu is all in a valley, and it is full of statues and shrines and temples that have been there for hundreds of years. You know, Kathmandu, Nepal specifically was the last Hindu kingdom, the last tantric meaning magical kingdom, and it's inhabited by Hindus, Buddhists, and shamanic practitioners, and they all kind of blend together. They share shrines, they share gods, they share techniques. It's like a chaos magic country. There's no other way to put it, or almost like a waking DMT trip because it's so colorful and full of ornate and arcane temples and structures and prayer flags, and you know, you can hear the sound of Tibetan Buddhist monks chanting spinning prayer wheels, and you know, animals and all kinds of stuff, traffic. It's amazing. So I wandered around, and you have to imagine that after a year of only doing magic and working on Generation Hex, and magic had become my whole life, I was a little bit nutty at this point, as you would imagine. So the idea of wandering into a war zone, you know, a covert war, it wasn't being conducted out in the open, but it was very dangerous to be there at the time. The idea of wandering into a war zone to seek further shamanic wisdom was, you know, that seemed normal to me, or it probably would not now, or maybe it would, but I was a little bit nutty at this time, but I'd read in my guidebook that shamanism was still practiced openly in Nepal, so I met a guide in the city square, Durbar Square, which very sadly, along, you know, all the stuff I'm describing was destroyed in the earthquake, the recent earthquake. It's tragic. But I met a guide and I asked him about shamanism, and he said, well, they teach it in my, or they practice it rather in my village up in the mountains. Why don't you accompany me up there? So I said, yes, of course, as you do. Went up into the foothills of the Himalayas, met the shamans, watched them conducting rituals. At the end of that, they said, well, why don't we teach you? I said, okay, fine. That sounds good to me, as you do. So then I ended up spending the next 2 weeks waiting out the Maoist insurrection and almost being kidnapped at one point, which luckily I was protected from. Waiting out the insurrection while studying Nepali shamanism, which was definitely a new level in my understanding of existence and magic, certainly. So it's with that kind of background that I came back to New York to work in the publishing industry. Of course, they wanted me to stay in Nepal. They said, you know, look, you know, forget going back to New York. Stay here for 7 years, marry a Nepali girl, practice shamanism, and in 7 years or so, we'll teach you how to fly and turn into a tiger. At the time, I thought, that sounds really good, but I really, you know, I have a job waiting for me back in New York. Kind of want to see my family again. Kind of want to see my girlfriend again. Not sure that was the right choice to leave, but here I am. So it's with that kind of background that I came back to New York, finished Generation Hex, published it, and it was in that mindset that I did the following talk that you're about to hear, which was me and seven other of the contributors on stage at Alex Gray's Chapel of Sacred Mirrors, very graciously being introduced by Alex and Allison, who are always very you know, warm and supportive of me, which I'm very grateful for. So it was kind of a panel, a group discussion about magic. And obviously, I'm very young in this in this talk. I'm very obviously naive, obviously idealistic, enthusiastic, maybe over-enthusiastic. And I'm not sure how many of the views that I express I would still hold today. But I want to present it to you, you know, carte blanche, as it were, without trying to put any language on it, saying that, you know, I don't want to contradict any of the ideas that I have here, because I think that if they're useful to you or they're inspiring to you, then perfect, right? You don't. I think that this talk stands on its own as a document of what it was, which was the enthusiasm of young people getting into magic and deciding they could change the world with it. And I think that that's a beautiful thing. And, you know, obviously there's reality checks, and it's been a long, hard reality check for 10 years after this, but I present it to you as it is to hopefully be of inspiration to you as you are now, where you are now, whoever you are. Okay. And with that, I leave you to it. You can still get Generation Hex. It's out of print, but you can still get it on Amazon used fairly cheaply. And the work continues in all the other books I published, and Ultra Culture, the website, and magic.me, the school. So yes, and before we get into the talk itself, I'd like to say that if you're interested in learning magic, and you like this podcast, the number one way to support me making more episodes of this show is to go to magic.me, that's magic.me, and take some courses or subscribe to the site. That's a full course on learning every single angle of magic, everything that's going to be talked about in the in the recording you're about to hear. And chaos magic, shamanism, yoga, meditation, thalema, everything. Tarot, I Ching. If you're, you know, if you're vibed up by listening to this, go take a class. There's also a free ebook and a free email course. But take a class, please. Okay. And with that, I take you 10 years back in time to the launch of Generation Hex. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the Generation Hex event, and I'm really happy you all came. You just saw Maldoror, A Pact of Prostitution by Mickey Pellerano. He's over there. Let me introduce everybody. Mickey Pellerano. Angelina Fabro. Atman. James Curcio. Rachel Haywire. And Sean Frente. And I'm Jason Liu, and I edited this book. Who? Who all of these lovely people are in, and each of them wrote a chapter about magic, either from an autobiographical or a practical angle. Every one of them from a generational angle. And essentially what this book is arguing is that there are extremely strange things happening to this generation, much like all other generations, and that we're trying to find a cultural high watermark here in dark 2005. Each one of these people talks about magic and what it is to them. And we're going to open this whole thing up into a panel discussion to try and flesh out what that is and why we should care, what it means to us in the modern world. And we're just going to go from there. So I'll give my general definition of magic, which is that I think it's pushing the boundary of achievable reality. And the way that we do that is by pushing our nervous systems to new frontiers. Ultimately, I actually think that it is our way of resisting culturalization and resisting socialization instead of listening to this endless distraction that our reality is, instead of listening to our own genetic code and our own reason for being on this planet and what we really, really are here to do, instead of what we are constantly distracted into, which is the endless tedium and meaninglessness of 21st century life. So I think it's imperative that we start accessing these things, start figuring out new ways of being in the world and new ways of perceiving, new ways of interacting with each other, because otherwise we probably don't have that much longer. And for me personally, I think that magic is a path and as a practice and as an area of culture and study is, for me, it's the way to do that. It's definitely one of the most viable and important ways of doing that. So anyways, I'm going to let each person introduce themselves and tell you a little bit about what they wrote about in the book.
My name is Mickey Pellerano, and I wrote an article in the book called The Science of Suchness. And it's an article about how psychedelic experience can be an asset to, I guess, what I call the great work. And that goes along with my definition of magic. I definitely see magic. I agree totally with what Jason said, and it's a way of obviously creating change in one's reality or one's eternal life. But I guess I also see magic as a process of becoming more godlike in a way, and moving beyond the intellect or the ego and kind of tapping into the infinite powers of the mind and the self, which are buried within. Thank you.
Hi, Hi, I am Angelina Fabro, and my selection in Generation Hex is called Your Lucky Hand. I come from Vancouver, British Columbia, where I am a yoga teacher, and I'm also sort of a scientist in training. I'm working on a cognitive systems degree at Simon Fraser University right now. Magic for me is, I don't know if I'd put it in sort of the same category as most, pagan, I would say, or even a lot of occult types would, because of my scientific background. My article is about the synthesis of spirituality and science and how these areas really do overlap in the 21st century. There's a lot of research out there that suggests that the mind over matter argument has more merit than people have traditionally given it. So that's what my selection is about. And magic to me is a word that really, really, I have to agree with what Jason said. It's like taking advantage of all of the available options you have in reality and using your consciousness to break forward in progress. So I like the synthesis of both of those as a tool for doing so.
I'm Atlan. I live in Chicago. More or less been a full-time freak for 6 or 7 years now. I wrote a piece, Fast Forward to Meltdown, which was my offering to those who take psychedelic drugs and attempt to do ritual magic while high on them. It can go lots and lots of ways, yes, yes. In any direction you can imagine, and many you can't. I will conclude by saying that this man's work has been an inspiration to me, and I'm honored to be here.
Well, I'm James Curcio. I'm an artist and a musician and a writer. My chapter for Generation Hex was called Living the Myth. What I really wanted to focus in on was magic as a process of creating meaning for ourselves and also culturally. I think that the role of a magician and the role of the artist are, if not the same, incredibly similar. I think that the tools that we associate with magicians are kind of outdated in a way. I mean, some people might find use in them, and then that's great, but you don't need a wand necessarily. You don't need a funny hat. These are metaphors that can be used to create change in other people's brain state and in your own. I receive a lot of emails about, since this book came out, since some other books of mine came out as well, I actually wanted to read something, a question that someone asked me about the occult, because I thought it was somewhat enlightening and also a little amusing. My name is Rebecca Lake, and I'm a student at Sydney, Australia. In the spirit of Halloween, I'm writing an article for my school paper on the fascination with the occult and pop culture, and I was hoping you could answer the following question for me. How would you define your interest in the occult? Is it a detached interest or the concept as a whole? An appreciation for the aesthetic, or do you have an active appreciation for it? Why do you think the occult is such an enduring and growing in pop culture literature? And finally, what relationship does Halloween have in the 21st century with the occult? Thank you for your time, Rebecca Lake. And I responded, Rebecca, I'm not sure I can give you anything but my opinion on these subjects, but I will give you that. In truth, that's all we have when it comes to cultural trends anyhow. In this case, given the long-standing connection between figures in pop and mainstream rock culture and the occult, David Bowie, Jimmy Page come to mind most immediately. What's possibly most surprising is the fact that it's taken so damn long to come to a head, if that's indeed what's happening. My personal feelings on the matter is that many of the trappings of the occult, those that are commonly associated with Halloween, incidentally, such as pentagrams, late night seances in graveyards, and so on, are many of the things that are holding the worthwhile elements of magic and the occult back. These psychological and cultural elements have already been recognized in many corners of more accepted disciplines, such as marketing and science, and will most likely continue to be more effective within that framework so long as the occult is the realm of the supernatural rather than simply an open-minded, open-ended scientific method stripped of the materialistic presuppositions many pin upon science. For example, what's supernatural about telepathy? Birds and bees have been using some form of simultaneous immediate communication for some time. It's also worth noting, as you may know, the occult, alchemy, and science all sprang from the same mental and historic real estate, and they didn't come full-formed like Athena. I may have a passing attachment to the aesthetic of the occult, as it's associated with dark things, quote-unquote, like goth and industrial culture, but that probably has more to do with the mental ease that comes along with not having to color coordinate in the morning. Black and black always matches. As you can see, then a belief that these things have some real efficacy based on the aesthetic. In other words, a seance in the graveyard listening to Current 93, no offense to David Tibet, may work, but so my Christian faith healing. I think in terms of the actual principles at work, Christianity and Current 93 have nothing to do with it. But maybe that's my own presuppositions at work. Still, it's worth considering that Catholics don't tend to see visions of Vishnu, and most Hindus don't see the Virgin Mary. Finally, my books to date have been lumped for various reasons into the category of occult psychology, whatever the hell that is, so I guess I'm some kind of authority on the subject. Maybe there are higher incidents of original, interesting people in the subculture associated with this theme, and that is appealing to me. But there is also, at times, a higher incidence of mental instability and poverty, the former being something I only enjoy in small, controlled doses, and the latter being something I'd like to distance myself from personally as quickly as possible. Anyhow, that actually points out a few things, I believe, with problems in general with all spiritual institutions, that being that, for instance, with Christianity, we have a symbol system that's based on a worldview that's at least 2,000 years out of date. Yeah. So, and it's not that the symbols themselves, or at least the structure behind the symbols, is useless. In fact, it's completely useful. It's human, and it's our method of, you know, finding meaning from reality. But nevertheless, if we don't update our symbols soon, we're going to have some serious problems. I think a lot of the wars going on right now are a result of that fact. So I think magic is incredibly relevant right now as a means, hopefully, for all of us to look at the symbols at use and that we use to create meaning and hopefully do something about it as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Hey, so I was going to do this Gothic Nord performance art, but I figured I would just, you know, give a speech and tell you guys who I am. I'm Rachel Haywire. I have an article. It's called Eris is My Biatch. I've also got a tattoo. It's the same thing. I'll show you guys. Eris is my biatch because a lot of Discordians are a little floppy. In fact, a lot of people into the occult are a little floppy sometimes. And I meet so many people, they're talking about like candles and incense and very pagan, basic beliefs. And for all of you guys that are just getting into magic, don't think that all of us are like that. I mean, as you can see, we've got a really diverse crowd over here. I mean, James is talking about goth and industrial culture, and, you know, Jason was saying the 21st century is boring, and this is all part of magic. Reality is your toy. And my article is about traveling from city to city and making reality my toy, making Eris my biatch, having a good time, because reality is fun. You can do anything. It's like a painting. No, what are you going to paint today? How are you going to go in this dimension? What dimension are you going to go over there? You know, flipping a little over there. And it's a good time. Magic is really fun, and I'm really happy to be here right now. And I hope you guys enjoy my article. It's about traveling from city to city. That's what I do. I'm still a traveler. I go everywhere. I go to shows. I go to readings, concerts, performance art shows. I go to everything, and I have a good time. And I think the magic is about living everyday life to the most that you can. Fuck shit up if you want. Take reality, break it in half. Whatever you want to do, just have a good time. I'm really glad to be here tonight.
My name is Sean Fronte. It's my chosen name. And my article is called The Sum of All Scenes, which is about... It's about rave culture. It's about the hope to develop forms of consciousness that go beyond individual egoic boundaries. So, what is magic? Jason Louvre actually hits just so many definitions of it that I'm using one of his surplus ones that I think he said in some state of sleep deprivation, and which is magic is semiotics plus orgasm. That may not completely answer what it is, because you can never actually completely answer what magic is. If you ever have a totalizing definition, I think, then it's over. yeah, exactly. Post-magic. For me, it's primarily something, it's something you do, but it's also a way of knowing. My interests and my background are stuffy and academic. I I've been processed through, you know, studying linguistics and semiotics and film semiotics and blah, 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 blah. And basically I spent a lot of time, as you know, academics tend to do, making things like sex and death really boring, which is why you know, you leave it and do something else. Having come out of this system, I still, and I want to talk about this more when we open up, I still have a lot of truck with the Western mode of philosophical inquiry. Magic is a mode. It's something different, and it's something that is not bound by what we call, you know, by the logos in Western philosophy, or the mode of consciousness, which is circumscribed by language. So I think magic is something that allows us to communicate, and it's not just like, you know, telepathy, like zapping a picture of a cheese sandwich into your head. But I think magic allows for us to evolve in knowledge systems which go beyond language. So that's why it's very difficult to talk about magic, because we're still using language to talk about it. And I think that's where magic today is going, and where in the past, you know, like people get caught up in like saying the magic words, or like, you know, like secret things that you can say. That's still within what I think is, you know, traditionally the logos. And I think what we're getting at now is something that goes beyond that. So hopefully that... Thank you.
So I definitely wanted to say a huge thank you to Alex and Allison Gray for having us here. And hopefully we'll live up to the space. So yeah, a lot of that was really interesting, and I think we're just going to kind of break into panel discussion, but I wanted to riff on a few things that people said there. First of all is that word magic, which has to be the silliest and most embarrassing word possible. And during the 2 years when I was editing this book, I kind of struggled constantly for something new to call it, but I couldn't come up with anything, and eventually I decided, well, fuck it, I'll call it magic, because it's just a huge middle finger to everything we take for granted on a daily basis is based on. And Aleister Crowley put a K on the end of magic to distinguish it from stage magic. He called it magic, which sounds like the comic book store guy from The Simpsons giving you a lecture. And I took off the K in the book because I think it's dumb. he had very erudite Kabbalistic reasons for doing that, which are all very sound. But there's a really interesting point there in the difference between a stage magician and a real magician, which at first I thought was just, okay, I think we can get past that. Everybody knows they're different. But I kind of came to the conclusion with some of the things I had read that, you know, essentially the difference between a stage magician and a real magician is a stage magician is somebody who gets on stage and tries to produce illusions. A real magician is somebody who tries to dispel illusions. And my phone is ringing. It's Genesis Peorage, even better. Hey, Jen. How you doing? I'm going to hand you over. I'm actually on stage. I'm going to hand you over to somebody who can give you better directions. All right, sorry. But I think that, you know, essentially when you start talking about magic, it stops becoming about individuals, and it starts becoming about culture as a whole and where we're all going. And when you talk about dispelling illusions, I really think that that means breaking down everything that we take for granted and realizing that nothing is given. It's all a story that's been told to us by somebody. Everything is negotiable, and going back down to zero and then building up, going into the void. And in my case, I went into the void and came out with a lot of weird stuffed animals in an apartment in Queens. But, oh, that too. But when we talk about magic, it really becomes indistinguishable from art, language, like Sean was saying, literature, sex. It's all things. It's about creating something from nothing and pulling rabbits out of hats. And if you go back to human prehistory, it's really all the same thing. And if you go back to the original tribes, it'll be a bunch of hunter-gatherers, the tribal chief, and then the shaman. And the shaman was the original profession that subsumed all authoritarian roles, but one of those roles was the
the person who was able to define reality for everybody else. And now the professions have been broken up. Now we have doctors, we have lawyers, we have people that have expertise that we don't have that we have to go to. But the one thing that's been lost in all of that is that very magical function. We don't really have that in our culture anymore, but it's, you know, I don't think anyone can argue that it's just sitting here. You can see it's coming back. Why that is, maybe some other people can riff on. Well, I think it's a choice. We can allow somebody to define reality for us, and if you take the tribal society and blow it up macro level to a 21st century society, that shaman role, the guy drawing the cave paintings on the walls that we all mistake for reality, that defines everything that we see, that's somebody like Ted Turner or Rupert Murdoch who controls the world's media. That's the shaman in today's world. It's not the guy at Burning Man giving you a rub down with essential oils. But it's true. These people define reality in a very tangible and pressing ways. The choice is either we go with that and allow, you know, oh, there's weapons of mass destruction. Okay, fine, I'll go with that. Or we take control of the image factory. We take control of the very human and essential function of life, which is to define reality for ourselves. Take control of our own existences. That's the choice. You can't give up control of your reality to somebody else because look what happens. I've been really kind of down about the way things have been going for a long time, but I kind of have this inexplicable feeling that things are getting better. I kind of have a feeling that over the last 6 years or so since democracy stopped existing in this country, I think the most hopeful thing that's going to come out of that is that people en masse kind of had their faces ground into what happens when you relinquish to control to these corporate concerns who don't have our best interests in mind. And we're seeing what happens when we don't take control of our own communities, we don't take responsibility, is a better way to put that, when we don't take responsibility for our own lives and the people around us. And that means everything. We each need to take responsibility of our own universe, essentially. Anybody else want to continue?
No, I'll probably change the subject, actually, slightly. But not the main subject, which is magic and how we do it. So this is an anecdote about being young and foolish and doing magic anyway. I was young and foolish, and there were a bunch of us in a very small room on a lot of acid. That's the setting. And we didn't really do magic, any of us. But we started to. People started referring to things in symbolic terms. We weren't in an apartment on the 14th floor. We were on the Mesa, you know. And we started building something kind of like an altar, sort of in the middle of the room. And somebody had laid out this sort of semicircle of flowers that you couldn't really get over to get out of this one room. Let me tell you, it wasn't that we hadn't done psychedelic drugs before because we had. But what we hadn't done was added this element that drove us all more or less entirely nuts. The apartment was completely evacuated. Many of our friends had to be called. I was dragged kicking and screaming a mile and a half home. Somebody ended up in the hospital for a little while, and then ended up in the hospital the next day for the allergic reaction to the drugs they gave him to counteract the drugs. Nor was this the last time I tried to do psychedelic drugs and ritual magic, although it was the first. Nor was this the last time that bad results came out of it. Now, the question you might ask, and I certainly asked myself a couple of times, is why continue to do this? Because, well, I guess there's the I'm an intensity junkie answer, but more to the point, I mean, I'm just going to guess here that some of y'all have had psychedelic experiences, and I'm going to further guess that they've been fairly important to you. You know, you're here now, it seems likely. What that brings to a human consciousness basically is amplification, and then the intent brings the rest to it. Now, I mean, I know people who have not gotten a lot out of this other than a more intense football game, for instance, but when you take magical techniques, which are all about solidifying your intent, amplifying your intent, and getting it all clear, Y'all ever been at a party and felt the air kind of thicken because everybody's got the groove right and it's going good? That's orgone energy.
Yeah.
That is our stuff for manifesting in this world. That's how we do it. That is the substance which allows idea to become fact. And if y'all know of a better way than getting a bunch of people together on psychedelic drugs to do ritual magic together to raise up a ball of orgone, let me know, because I'm all ears and I'll probably show up. Bingo. You know, I think there's something there. So this is basically my call out, you know? I've had a few go well, I've had a few go poorly, and I want to hear what y'all have to say about it sooner or later.
Okay, so you want to do magic, right? Nobody's nodding their heads. Come on. That's the theme. Okay, so we want to do magic. We come from this conventional Western background where we're told that's not possible. Nope. Silly. That's reserved for the Harry Potters. That's reserved for the... Oh, somebody throw me a good fantasy movie.
Gandalf?
Yeah, it's reserved for Gandalf, Dungeons and Dragons. The geeks that like to sit in a dark room and, you know, role play. But that's kind of odd in a way, because that's sort of what magic is. But, you know, we'll come back to that. So anyway, you want to do magic, right? You know, a lot of people struggle with magic because they come from this conventional Western idea that it's not possible. And then they discover that, hey, there's a group of people that do believe it is possible. And suddenly you've got to change your whole belief structure and paradigm to accept that this is, in fact, possible. And it sounds really easy. Like, I'm just going to change what I think. But if you've had, you know, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, depends how old you are, of programming that says it's not possible, it can be a big hurdle. Part of the reason that I approached the, you know, magical community with my writing and my work to do with, you know, synthesizing, you know, possible ways that science and magic cross over is because there is the willingness to believe. On one hand, it's a lot easier to put new ideas into the brains of people, you know, that come to these sorts of events than it would be if I went to, you know, one of my professors and said, hey, how about this? You know? And so on one hand, the willingness to believe is fantastic. On the other hand, you know, and this is what I admire about the scientific community, and something that Aleister Crowley was really big on, is skepticism towards your work. You know, so I really think that, you know, that's sort of why I brought this to plate with this particular audience. Some really interesting things to note is, maybe I'll throw some of the most recent research out there, is as to date, I think everybody knows about, or maybe not everybody knows about, Schrodinger's cat, your perception of whether or not a certain cat's going to be dead based on a random variable of it being poisoned. And you should read the book, because I talk about it. So just go get the book if that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to you. And there's the famous double slit experiment in physics where, you know, scientists will emit photons. And as soon as they discover the nature of one photon, they will immediately know that the other photon has the same nature. And that's a very interesting one as well. My most favorite research recently is the Pearson Engineering and Anomalies Research Department. Princeton Engineering and Anomalies Research Department. And what this particular department has been doing for about 12 years as of 1997 or 1998 is experiments on whether or not human will can affect the outcome of a random number generating machine. And after 12 years of research in 1998 was when this article was published, and over 2 million different trials, and a confirmed population of these trials, the entire population of them, none of them were people that openly professed to having any supernatural or psychic ability. So this is just average Joe off the street. They found that while the effect size wasn't large, there was a very statistically significant amount that they had to acknowledge. So it's very interesting to see what's coming out of the research these days, because there's more and more support that shows that when you think something, it's not just going off to nowhere. It's, you know, that information is going to be doing something. Now, you know, we like to sit here and talk a lot about, you know, what magic does. But sometimes, you know, you sit back and you wonder, well, why? Why? What is happening when I do magic? And so that's really what I'm trying to bring to plate with my article there, is to show some of the research. As of like today, we'll say, you know, there is no real confirmed research that says, okay, your will can definitely be causally implied to affect reality. But there's such a strong correlation there that it's really not far behind. And, you know, I'm always trying to stay on top of what's being researched. And as magicians, I think you should too. Don't be shy of those funny studies that have really strange numbers in them somewhere. You know what I mean? Just get them, you know, brush up on your statistics a little bit and find out what science is doing. Because there are some institutions out there and there are some areas of science that are really complementary to magic. For example, I'm actually working on an essay right now that talks about biological models for healing. And as a yoga teacher, you know, I try and incorporate a little bit of magic into what I'm doing. When my students are doing pranayama, I ask them to visualize oxygen flooding their cells. Or when they're stretching and, you know, I can tell some students are having a real tough time in a particular asana, you know, visualize your muscle fibers elongating, feel yourself relaxing. And all of this makes a really big difference. It's all little things that we can do that almost stems from a similar field of positive psychology. So I think I'll turn this over to somebody else. Maybe we'll come back to it. And Mickey.
Hey. One of the things addressed earlier was how magic has become really popular in sort of popular culture. So, you know, Harry Potter and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and this and that. And why that is, it would be good to say that human beings' minds are sort of evolving and kind of becoming more receptive to things like magic, and maybe that's true, but I don't know, because magic is really fun and really sexy, but I think it's really intense and I think it's really scary, and I don't think that it's suited for everybody. And I think that you kind of really have to go through a lot if you really want to get serious about it. I'm really bummed out about Kabbalah and sort of what's going on right now with it, because the thing about Kabbalah, as I always understood, it's a really esoteric practice. I mean, it requires a lot of mental power just to sort of wrap your mind around the concepts presented by Kabbalah. So the thought that something like Kabbalah can just be marketed so easily and that people will buy it, I see as a little bit distressing and bad, because I don't think it's meant for the people, and I don't think it's meant for everybody who can afford it. I think it's meant for people who are qualified to practice it.
I have something to add to that really, really quickly. There's a lot of push right now with magic becoming more and more popular. A lot of people feeling like, oh, well, this is such a great, you know, thing that I think people should realize that they can do this. Well, let's get it out there to as many people as possible. It's almost comparable to, like, say, Timothy Leary and Terence McKenna in terms of psychoactive substances. You've got Timothy Leary, who took the stance of, like, let's get it to as many people as possible. And then you've got Terence McKenna, who is kind of like, you know, no, let's just take the people that are experienced with it, the people that find it themselves, and let's see how far they can go. So there's two different perspectives here. It really feels like to me, with the way that consciousness is changing as we move out of the information age and more into, like, it's almost like an age of knowledge. It's like everybody realizes at this point, so we all know everything, now what do we do with it? You know what I mean? And magic is sort of a real excellent tool for that realization. Like, once you've reached the realization of, you know, we are all connected, in, you know, even particle level, if you want to go science, or on an energetic level, you know, now that we have all these realizations of the 21st century, what do we do with them? People will know when magic is ready for them. Because I think that all of us, you know, within us have the divine capacity as human beings to tap our, you know, genetic memory and to tap where we're going in consciousness is sort of, we're coming back to this whole group consciousness thing. And I think that people will eventually just get to it themselves. Like, people have to, you know, come to the realization to make it meaningful to them in any case. So, I'm not even too concerned about the whole, like, push towards getting it out to everybody. I think that it's just happening on a natural course of things. And as a result, you know, we're having this event. And somebody else can go from there.
Yeah. Actually, I wanted to add a couple things to that. One is, you guys know about Kabbalah energy drink, right? Ashton Kutcher and Madonna are marketing Kabbalah energy drink. I'm not making this up. And you know, the red bracelets and all that, and there's buses that drive around Las Vegas now that say Kabbalah on the side. One thing that we're realizing, that magic and science, especially science now with the idea of Rupert Sheldrake's theory of the morphogenic field and other theories, is we're beginning to realize, and I think this is absolutely essential to the magical worldview, is that consciousness is a field. It's not individual, and it doesn't even necessarily have to do with human beings. It's a field. That's really a huge part of it. If it's good enough for one person, it has to be good enough for everybody, I think. And the flip side of that is, you don't want to push what's important to you on everybody else. Everyone has to come to it. But one of the things with magic, as with Angelina was saying, you can almost see it as tapping genetic coils. I think Carl Jung said there was a collective unconscious. I think if he was alive today, he would say it's in the DNA. I mean, where is it more likely to exist, out in the ether, some like intangible ether, or in the DNA that everybody shares? I don't know, kind of like hardware that we're all accessing a collective internet with, to use a current metaphor. So I see the huge popularization of magic as a good thing, and the biggest thing about that is that it's harder to burn people when everybody's into it. You know, obviously, there's going to be a really shallow Britney Spears and her husband reading out of the Torah over their child and saying that's Kabbalah. I actually think it makes the climate more amenable for the serious people than if it was completely unheard of. Because now there's need for it. Now people want to know like the deeper tradition. Now people want to know more about it, just like with anything. And the more these things get commercialized and the more they get out into the mainstream, the more new stuff we have to come up with and the further we have to go and the more we have to push the horizons. So I see it as a good thing. Obviously, it's annoying and irritating, but just the fact that, you know, Kabbalah is a trend now, like, think back 10 years, think back 20 years, that's just inconceivable. And what does that say about where we're going as a field consciousness? So.
Yeah, but I feel like it's a trend in a lot of ways because of capitalistic interests, not so much as spiritual.
I wanted to briefly add that if someone picks up a book by Rabbi Berg, who is the guy we're talking about here, the chances that they will then pick up a book by Arya Kaplan or Lon Milo Dukat go way up. And so for me, that's a good thing.
I had something else to say, but now let me riff on this. I'm not as ready to say that this is a good thing, that magic is in the air in this pop cultural way. I would have to say it's because I'm so disappointed with culture, with pop culture in general. And there's a skeptical part of me which sees this as a retreat into a sort of delusion. I sometimes think like of contemporary America now, and I know this is talked about all the time, sort of like the retreat into symbolic, you know, ancient arcane symbols that happened in Germany in the 20s. Siegfried Krakauer's work From Caligari to Hitler is sort of saying like this German expressionism and this sort of like obsession with the occult and the arcane, you know, leads to Hitler. Now, that's super reductionist version of Krakauer there. There's a plus and a minus. On the one hand, people's minds, what they're willing to go into, may be more permeable than ever, but I think there's a dark side to that, which is that they can retreat away from any sort of hard thinking. And I think that's what magic always has to come back on, is as far out as you can go. This is something that Robert Anton Wilson quotes from Ernest Hemingway, is you need a built-in bullshit detector. And if you don't have that, then you're going to be drinking Kabbalah energy drink and, like, you know, and goose-stepping and, you know. So I think that, like, you know, part of my magical work, my magical thinking, is looking at the way cultural trends work together and finding currents. And so I think that's something that has to be done now. And I even think that there's a huge magical history that has to be written, and things that seem disparate that have to be pulled together. How these pockets of the world have done the same things that have, you know, like, why did the same cultures pop up in, you know, Detroit, Manchester, and Germany, making the same things, and making, if you don't know your musical history, throughout the last 30 years, these cities have produced this very specific kind of electronic music with very, very similar cultural happenings. This segues into my greater point, which is that even if you don't give a shit about magic to begin with, what I see happening now is space is being created where it just sort of happens. And my background was sort of rave culture. I was never like I never wore fat pants or like, you know, I never had candy bracelets or, although I did wear a furry suit a couple months ago. It was kind of a necessity.
Shut up, rabbit.
But something that I've noticed is that when I was the most involved with electronic music culture, I mean, I personally had a background with the esoteric. I grew up, you know, as a teenager reading, you know, like Robert Anton Wilson, and sort of like this whole idea that you can reprogram your mind. The Discordian Society was a big influence on me. My fake church is called the Church of Disco Discordia. So. So that was in my head. But then what I noticed is that, you know, people who had no background in anything like this, that were going to raves, taking lots of drugs, dancing, were producing these occult moments that you can actually, as Adman was saying, you know, these kids don't care. They don't give a fuck about Aleister Crowley. But at the same time, you feel this very thick orgone energy. And you start to feel like it's the way I think about a group consciousness is the way, if you've ever watched fish swim, if you've ever watched a flock of birds fly together, there's like a mind that's sort of like working together, and like they're not telling each other, they're not like squawking like, all right, you wing, like hard left, like it's not like that. But under the right circumstances, magical things happen just by themselves. I think within modern industrial culture, this is happening for the first time in a certain way, now more than ever, to quote, you know, who. So I think that is a plateau that, you know, our generation has that other people have not necessarily, that these things are just, it's sort of like, if you read that book, The 100th Monkey, you know, it's sort of like a bunch of monkeys can just be doing, you know, their own monkey thing, and then suddenly one monkey comes into existence and it sort of sparks this group mind that happens. And I think that has been sort of on the horizon for the last 30 years or so.
Actually, I wanted to jump into something else that was brought up a little while ago. We keep talking about psychedelics and magic. It can be an important part of the process, but it's not requisite by any means. And so I kind of want to make that clear. In my experience, I got into it kind of by accident, I think, as is true with a lot of us. My friends and I started going back in the woods. We were speaking of Vox Pop. Jason and I were joking about this. Like, how many people went back in the woods and did strange shit? Things started spontaneously happening. I remember one night we went out there and we weren't reading books on meditation or magic. We weren't, and we're just, I mean, I guess for the most part, we're typical suburban kids. We started chanting and moving in like these concentric circles in a very specific way, and we started hearing a voice from the woods telling us to go somewhere. We followed, I mean, this whole kind of vision quest thing happened, and none of us were on drugs at that period of time. It was actually later on when we kind of were like, okay, this is what it's like sober, where can we go beyond this? It's not necessary. I just wanted to say that it can open the doors very quickly if you want a shortcut, but there's downside to that too. One other thing I wanted to mention that was brought up is that we keep talking about symbols and symbolism, and it might not be clear necessarily what the importance of symbolism is or how symbols can be useful. And it's kind of a hard thing to tackle in a moment, but whenever we refer to anything, whether it's by language, by an image, by a sound, it's this reference. And so we can look at everything that we experience in our everyday lives also as a reference. And then you can ask the question, what is it referring to? We talk about reality, but really the reality we talk about, at least experientially, is our reality. And at the same time, that doesn't mean there's not a reality out there. It's just unknowable except through these symbols and signs and portents. And that's where magic comes in, I think. It can be a process of finding an intermediary between you and other people and you and the world if you open yourself up to it.
So I want to touch on the issue of exploring all areas of consciousness, not just the bright and happy areas. I want to talk about the dark shit. You know, people were saying not everybody's ready for magic. You know what? Some of us aren't. Maybe I wasn't ready. I wanted to try shit out. I wanted to invoke a bunch of stuff and see what would happen. I called out every demon that existed. My life has been nuts. But the thing is, I'm ready, you know? You know, I'm here to explore. That's what it's about. I'm about delving in. And I think that a lot of the darker areas of consciousness are expressed in industrial and gothic subcultures. And yeah, maybe they don't know about Crowley, and maybe they've never read Robert Anton Wilson, but they are living in an alternative universe, and we're creating our own aesthetics, we're creating our own sounds, and what we're doing is exploring these different areas of the mind that the majority of people are afraid to go to. And I also want to talk about noise music. I think a lot of you might be familiar with it, and I see noise as magic because it's breaking down the patterns of music, just like we're breaking down the patterns of reality. Our writing, whatever we can do to get out what's going on in our minds, no matter how dark it is, no matter how fucked up it is, no matter how sick it is, I think it's important for us to express this shit. And if we do, then we can have a culture where people are not afraid to leave this positivity box. They're not afraid to give vibes. They're not good. Anyway, I think that it would be a good time to open it up so you guys could ask questions.
Yeah, we definitely want to have as much audience participation and questions as we can get. I wanted to bring up a couple things. One, responding to yours, magic, culture, and art are like that. It's really, at a certain point, it stopped becoming about reading all these books and thinking of it as the separate discipline, that like somehow separate of reality. It's this. What is magic? It is us. It is this.
It's reading the writing on the walls of eternity. It's the entire system, looking at the entire system and looking at the little eddies and flows and where you can push, even give a tiny little push to change everything. And specifically what James said is I want to address what I call the just the factor. I just made that up. This really became an issue for me while I was writing the book and trying to intellectually get my head around this to write about this, which is that especially because so many people come into magic and look at it and come into it trying to disprove it, which is how I got into it, how James got into it, probably some of the other people here, Angelina. Like, oh, this is nonsense. Like, I remember when I was 14, when I first 14, 15, the first time I got into this, I would like look. My first exposure was looking around at like all these like looking in the bookstore and like you go into the occult bookstore and it's or the occult section of the bookstore and it's the worst section, the one you really don't want to be in. There's airbrush dragons and mermaids and like these oversized paperbacks about the 21 lessons of Merlin or whatever. Like, you got that one, yeah. And to me, when I was that age, when I was like super cynical about everything, slightly more than I am now, that was horrible to me. I thought that that was the tackiest, worst thing I could ever consider, the idea of magic. It was, I had this extreme revulsion to it.
Okay, so the recording, I think, cut off there, unfortunately. That's all that I have of the recording. There's a bit missing. The recording was made by James Curcio. And I believe, hopefully, I will at some point come up with the rest of the talk, but I'm not sure there was too much more to it, so you've gotten almost all of it. So thank you for listening, and if you dig this show, please go to magic.me, magick.me, and dive into learning magic through taking video trainings online. Okay, thank you very much, and see you next time.